Good evening and welcome to the Celeste Bartos Information Center here at the New York Public Library. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, I'm Paul LeClaire, the president of the most wonderful library in the world, the New York Public Library. And on behalf of our wonderful chairman, Katie Marin, and on behalf of our ever-enterprising co-chairs of the President's Council of the Library, Louise Greenwald, Gayford Steinberg, and Alice Tisch, I'm delighted to welcome you to an evening that I'm sure is going to be vivid in our minds and memories for a very, very long time to come, namely a conversation between Neil Ferguson of Harvard University and James Surowiecki of The New Yorker. But before introducing our special guests, just a few words about what's happening at the library these days. First, and I realize that this is at the risk of sounding immodest, but I think I can actually characterize the library today as one of the highest performing, most efficient, and most consequential organizations in this great city. We're serving more people in more diverse ways than we ever have before. Last year, last calendar year, in the five boroughs of New York City, there were 40 million physical visits to public libraries. That's more than all the cultural organizations and all the sports teams combined, by about 1.5 to 2 million. So no one should labor under the illusion that libraries are not highly relevant today, especially in New York City, and no one should harbor the illusion that libraries are anything but essentially important public services in this town. At the same time, the operating budgets of our four research libraries, and you're the biggest one tonight, depend substantially on private sector donations, and we have an average weekly fundraising goal from the private sector of $400,000. And those contributions are necessary just to meet the basic operating costs of running the four research libraries. Any new additions to our program, any expansive digital programs, or any new kinds of customized service for patrons require additional fundraising over and above that goal. So what you within the President's Council do for us on an annual basis is immensely important and immensely appreciated. Your contributions count in significant ways towards helping us meet the $500 million target of our present ongoing Library for the Future campaign, an effort that will underwrite the dynamic evolution of the New York Public Library for the foreseeable future. And so just if by chance you haven't joined the President's Council already, I really urge you to do so. I think you couldn't find a better place to invest some, not necessarily all, but some of your philanthropic dollars than in the library and in the President's Council. And now on to our program. Neil Ferguson, whose most recent book we all know, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, Neil holds the Lawrence A. Tisch Chair in History at Harvard University, a chair created through a generous benefaction to Harvard by our trustee Jim Tisch and his wife Merrill, in honor of Jim's late father, Larry Tisch, whom many of us in this room knew and loved and admired. Professor Ferguson is also the William Ziegler Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. And if that weren't enough, he's also a senior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford. And if that weren't enough, he's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's the guy that gets around. He's been named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time Magazine, and he writes regularly for the Financial Times and Newsweek, and his books seem always to be converted into outstanding television documentaries. James Surowiecki is, of course, the author that we all read in The New Yorker, because we read his financial page, the regular financial and business column in that great magazine. He's also written for The New York Times Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, and Fortune. His most recent book is The Wisdom of Crowds, about the importance of the collective imagination in shaping business, economics, and society. Members of the President's Council, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Neil Ferguson and James Surowiecki.
Thank you. So I'm going to take interviewer's prerogative. I don't actually know if that prerogative exists, but I'll take it anyway. Just to say that thank you all for coming. And I was talking to someone, Louise, actually, before this event, and I was saying that this is not a thought that occurred to me tonight. It's a thought that occurs to me regularly, that if I were to decide the city budget, perhaps the last thing I would cut would be the libraries. To me, they just seem central to everything we want society to be and to democracy. So thank you all. And I'm glad Paul introduced Neil so I did not have to read his long list of publications, because it makes me feel bad to realize how much Neil has published and I have not. It's absolutely extraordinary. I had not realized until reading this the information sheet that Neil has also, amongst everything else you've already heard he's been doing, completed a biography of the banker Sigmund Warburg, and is working on a biography of Henry Kissinger. So he'll probably be done with that by next week, so you'll all be able to read it. But today, the title of our talk, or the interview, is The Ascent of Money and the Descent of the West, Historical Reflections on the Decade. And I think the way the conversation will work is we'll start with The Ascent of Money and talk a little bit about Neil's book and the way it frames, in some ways, in interesting ways, I think, what's happened over the past decade, and then spend a good deal of time on that second part, the decline of the West and the rise, perhaps, of Asia, which is in a way, the flip side of that concept. And not to get too deeply into the financial crisis, but I'm sure is something that's going to come up. So, in a way, let's start there. So in The Ascent of Money, one of the things you talk about and one of the themes that's really central to the book is the idea that financial innovation is really fundamental to economic growth, that actually you use the word indispensable, and that I think you say it's been an indispensable factor in man's advance. Is that still true? I mean, have the last few years, should they make us reconsider the role that financial... Have we reached a point at which financial innovation is now the equivalent of the atom bomb, where it's like, you know, physics was great until it got us to the hydrogen bomb?
Well, I don't think we've quite got to the hydrogen bomb financially. There have been very well-regarded people who have commented in recent months that finance actually adds nothing, economically or socially, that it is just some kind of parasitical and superfluous and indeed malign element in the economic system. And I was surprised to hear Adair Turner, who heads the Financial Services Authority in London, saying more or less that. Now, I suppose that was just to put the frighteners on the people running Royal Bank of Scotland so that they wouldn't pay themselves large bonuses. But it did seem to me somewhat ill-conceived, because the academic literature on the contribution of finance to economic development is extremely powerful and compelling. My good friend Richard Siller, who teaches at New York University, has been one of a number of eminent financial historians and economists who've shown just how important financial innovation has been to the development of the United States. Right now, when I do my day job, I'm supervising 5 different senior theses at Harvard right now, all due on Thursday. So I just want you to spare a thought for those young men. They haven't slept much lately, and they're dealing with my really rather hard-ass corrections even as we speak. But of those theses, a number are in fact concerned with the role of financial innovation in American development. There's a really excellent thesis being done on the innovation of deposit insurance, which you probably don't know actually dates back to the 1830s in New York State. There's another excellent thesis on the role of banks as signalers of creditworthiness during the great railroad boom at the end of the 19th century. And I could go on. It's very, very hard to imagine the economic development of the United States without the role of financial innovation and financial intermediation. And I'll go even further than that. If you look at the World Bank's a very, very extensive database on this, the correlation between poverty and lack of financial institutions, lack of financial intermediation, is really very clear. So this seems to me like a non-debate. There's no argument to be made that finance isn't necessary, isn't an integral part of human economic development. What is true, though, is that financial history is a tale of evolution. Innovation, rather as in the natural world of mutation, is a necessary part of this process, and it doesn't always work. The idea that you could create a system of finance so well regulated that there would never be a crisis is an absurdity.
Okay, wait, can I interrupt? So what's your take? One of the reasons why people feel the way they feel that you're talking about is that from 1940 35 to 19, depending on when, let's say 82, the developing nations crisis of the early 80s, there were effectively no crises in the post-war era. So people, and that was coupled with a system of pretty rigorous regulation. In the United States, there was no, you know, banks, there was no interstate branch banking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So is the correlation spurious? Can we go back to the, I mean, basically what people are saying today, people like Adair Turner or people in the United States, let's go back to the good old days. The 1950s, that's what people want to go back to.
I mean, I can't imagine quite why they want to go back to the 1950s. If you look at the 1950s, actually the volatility of growth was greater. There were some very deep recessions in the 1950s. And as for nostalgia for the 1970s, you have to be very, very young indeed to feel nostalgic about the 1970s. but that's important because, as you said, James, the timing of this argument is all really hinges on the 1980s. And I won't mention any New York Times columnists who've made this argument by name, but the claim that it all went wrong under Ronald Reagan with deregulation is dangerously close to becoming the conventional wisdom on what went wrong. And it's just absolutely wide of the mark in two ways. First of all, it implies that everything was great in the more regulated financial markets of the 1970s, which is absurd. If ever there was a malfunctioning decade in American post-war history, it was the 1970s, the decade of double-digit inflation, of stagflation. Sure, there were no major banking crises in the U.S., but there was a major banking crisis in the U.K. in the 1970s, right, despite the fact that there were exchange controls and a whole range of other controls in operation then. So I don't buy the idea that somehow it all went wrong in the 1980s, because that implies it was all fine in the 70s, which it clearly wasn't. And the other thing that's implausible about this argument is that the institutions that came close to blowing us up this time around were among the most highly regulated. It wasn't the unregulated hedge funds that were the problem in this crisis. It was the highly regulated commercial banks that became, as I think we all know, excessively leveraged. Now, if we just put this financial crisis and its macroeconomic aftermath into perspective, it certainly has not been so far Great Depression 2.0. In terms of the loss of output and the loss of employment, it's much closer to the early 70s and the early 80s recessions. So I think we have to keep some sense of historical perspective here. And before we conclude that this was all the fault of the Republicans in the 1980s, which I don't think we can plausibly claim, we need to consider the more plausible hypothesis that this crisis was the result of much more recent errors of monetary policy and lax enforcement of regulation. I mean, that's an important distinction. It's not a lack of regulation, but there was certainly a lack of enforcement of regulation on key areas of which bank leverage, bank balance sheet leverage, was the most important.
Okay, I want to go back to that. But before we do that, let's go back to the, before I interrupted you, this, the financial innovation. So you were saying that it's a history of evolution. But what do you think of the evolution of financial innovation in the last decade? Do you think it's added value in the way that previous innovations have added value?
Well, you know, there are a lot of innovations to cover in a discussion like this. Do you want to focus on credit default swaps? Do you want to look at the whole universe of derivatives, which exploded in size in a really very short space of time? Or do you want to talk about securitization, which started a little bit earlier but really reached its zenith in our time? The difficulty is that if we simply say that all these innovations were bad because they caused the crisis, we're not going to be sufficiently rigorous, and we're going to actually throw babies out with the bathwater. If we were to say,
but you think there's a baby there?
Oh, unquestionably, there were all kinds of benefits in this increasingly efficient mechanism for allocating capital and allocating risk. There's no question that not all of this was bad. And what went wrong, and we have to be really quite precise about this, has to do with a mixture of a monetary policy error from around 2002. And then a failure to recognize on the part of regulators all over the world, this was not peculiar to the United States, that banks were pursuing returns on equity through excessive leverage, and the liability side of the balance sheet was just waiting to blow up. Now, I pointed that out in 2006 and to universal scorn.
Is this the talk you gave where you gave the talk and then the guy was like, the hedge fund manager was like, next year let's see if we can watch a movie? Is that what it was? He wanted to have a thing? Can we watch Mary Poppins?
This was the Mary Poppins event.
Mary Poppins, right? Tell the story.
If you haven't read The Ascent of Money, I tell the story of how futile it was in late 2006 to persuade people in the financial services sector that they were overreaching. And that there was a really dangerous amount of leverage in the system. And the point that I was making was that if you are relying on liquidity the way people were relying on liquidity in 2006, watch out, because it can disappear overnight. And I just use historical examples to show this. And I try to argue that if that happened, a highly leveraged financial system would be on the brink of implosion. Well, I made this somewhat gloomy speech at Lyford Key at a Morgan Stanley conference in November of 2006. And subsequently, one of the clients, this was for their big hedge fund clients, complained to Steve Roach about the fact that they'd invited this morose Scottish Cassandra when all they had wanted to do was play golf with Sean Connery. I mean, he was the Scotsman they wanted. And he said, well, next year, Steve, instead of inviting this Harvard prophet of doom, why don't we just watch a movie? Let's watch Mary Poppins.
Did he know that it was about a bank? No, he had run.
But this innocent had obviously not watched Mary Poppins for a while. Unbeknown to him, I show a clip from Mary Poppins to my Harvard Business School class when I'm explaining what a bank run is, and so I said, great idea. Let's undoubtedly you should show your clients Mary Poppins. This is all happening in sort of early 07 because they really need to know what a bank run looks like. And if you haven't seen the movie for a while, go and look at that sequence. It's great. It's when Mary takes Michael to Mr. Banks's bank because the family name is Banks. The father works in a bank. They go to the bank and they try to persuade Michael to deposit his tuppence halfpenny pocket money at the bank. He actually wants to spend the money on feeding the pigeons. So there's a bit of a tussle, and he says, I want my money back. And two other clients of the bank overhear him, and one says to the other, did you hear that? They won't give that boy his money back. I think I want my money back. And the whole thing, in a kind of comic way, is an absolutely classic bank run. Now, nothing like that had happened in London since 1866. So when I watched those movies as a kid, it was really in the realm of ancient history.
Britain didn't have bank runs in the 30s.
No.
Unlike the United States.
No, the United States was very prone to bank runs.
Yeah, we had them constantly.
Right the way through, not only in the 30s, it was a recurrent feature of American life.
Yeah.
But the United Kingdom, after 1866, there was a radical change in the UK banking system in two ways. One, many, many fewer banks. There was enormous concentration. And two, the Bank of England read Walter Badgett's classic book, Lombard Street, which is still the best book on central banking ever written. And if you haven't read it, it's a joy to read because he was a brilliant journalist.
Yeah,
in many ways, a role model for anybody who writes on finance,
yeah,
as you
fantastic.
Do so brilliantly. I mean, Badgett, fantastic. Editor of The Economist, pioneered really good financial journalism in the English language. And he essentially told them what to do. In a major crisis, you lend long, lend generously, but at a penal rate. An interesting difference, really, between then and now, because we've learned generously at a zero rate.
Yeah, exactly, right. So in terms of the consequences, so financial innovation, you think there's some good. There's a baby somewhere in there, but been lost because our vision of the baby has been lost.
And we didn't gain from repressing innovation as we did in the post-war period. I mean, one forgets today. But interest rates were fixed. It was actually set by government what banks could pay on deposits and what they could lend at. And I don't think there were any gains from that kind of constraint on the financial system. It's not clear to me that you can see any benefit in terms of just the volatility of growth. I mean, the U.S. economy, although it grew rapidly in the 50s and 60s, didn't grow smoothly. And one reason for that was that the financial system was really quite constrained.
And so what do we do now? I mean, how do we save the baby while also getting rid of the bathwater?
Well, I think this is the key question, and you are making a contribution in the way that you identify the things that are wrong in the system and try to distinguish those from the things that aren't wrong. I mean, this is a terribly dangerous time because what seemed like it would be the work of technocrats the design for new regulations, what seemed like would be done by central bankers and regulators, spilled over into the realm of politics.
Right.
And as soon as it became a political football, and this is as true in Europe as it is here, the danger went to red alert level, because all kinds of mistakes could be made by politicians whose principal concern is not financial stability, but making sure that the blame for the crisis is parked as far away from Congress as is possible. And I do feel nervous about what will ultimately emerge in the great omnibus bill that is trundling its way through Congress, whether it will in fact be tackling the right things. Let me give you a single example. When in the wake of the Massachusetts election, the Volcker rules were pulled out of a hat by the president like a kind of regulatory rabbit, it was a little disconcerting to me, because the two things identified in these rules as being problems, proprietary trading by banks and the excessive size of banks measured in terms of liabilities, were not causes of the crisis. They clearly were not causes of the crisis. So I was at that point really a little unnerved. I'm a huge admirer of Paul Volcker. Much that he's written on this subject and said on this subject over the years, I agree with. But that distillation to produce new rules was really way off target. The problems that caused this crisis did not include proprietary trading by banks. They certainly included excessive bank leverage, but you can be highly leveraged as a small bank just as easily as you can be well capitalized as a big bank. So I think there's a danger that we're going to be tackling the wrong problems. This is all about how you do history. History is about essentially big crises, wars, revolutions, what people in this business call the fat tail events. That's what we do. And we try to work out what the real causes were. We try to use some kind of intellectual razor, to slice away the false causes and get at the right ones. Now, the ascent of money is partly an attempt to do that, because what it does is to say, our system has five pillars. Our financial system has evolved over centuries to have five pillars: banks, the bond market, the stock market, insurance, and the mortgage market. These are the five pillars of our financial system. And each of these pillars was in some way or another corrupted, undermined, or weakened in a relatively short period of time. And I'm a big believer in proximate causes as sufficient causes. Very often, the proximate cause will do. And most of the things that caused this crisis to happen can be traced back a relatively short time. You don't need to go back to the 1980s and say everything we did from that point on was wrong. The danger is that if we make that argument, we are going to completely distort the system. At the moment, the system is actually more vulnerable than it was before the crisis. We have a lot of work to do to make it crisis-proof in the future. But I don't see that work going in the right direction right now.
Do you actually think that's, I mean, do you think crisis-proof is a possibility, that that's a realistic goal?
Let me rephrase that. There will never be a financial system that is meaningfully capitalist that does not suffer crisis. The question is whether you can make yourself depression-proof. Recession-proof, I think that's out of the question. Joseph Schumpeter, the great thinker of mid-20th century economics, said there had to be creative destruction. We can't abolish the recession. If we try and abolish the business cycle, we know what happens. That was the 1970s, and we ended up with stagflation. But we do need to devise a way of avoiding a Great Depression. And we really, really narrowly missed it this time around. We came incredibly close to rerunning the Great Depression. If you'd asked me, if we'd had this conversation 12 months ago, when essentially all the indicators were tracking the 1929 to 31 trajectory almost perfectly, I would have been really very uneasy about what was happening. We avoided that, but we only just avoided it. And we have avoided it in ways that will have second-order consequences, some very uncomfortable. We avoided a Great Depression with a massive monetary and fiscal stimulus, unprecedented in peacetime. And the big question now is, what next?
Right.
That's the thing that I think most about. What happens now when you have had this massive explosion of public debt? There has to be a better way of operating than that, and that's why I want the focus to be particularly on excessive leverage on bank balance sheets. That was really the major problem. There are different ways of tackling that problem. That should be what we focus on. And number two, monetary policy. There was a major error of monetary policy by the Fed, because they took their eyes off asset prices as if they didn't count. Now, we have to address those problems, see that they are the key causes, and come up with solutions to those problems.
Okay, so I want to talk about the monetary and fiscal consequences of what just happened, because that's obviously a big part of your thesis about American decline or potential American decline. But before we go, let's stay with the crisis just for a little bit, and then we'll move on, which is in terms of the excessive leverage problem, which I absolutely agree with you on, in terms of banks just borrow too much money and then relent it out, essentially. One of the arguments for why we should restrict bank size is a political argument, that if you don't do that, that actually banks have simply too much power, and therefore it's not surprising that regulators let them get away with what they let them get away with. Is there anything to that?
I don't think that's plausible, because there's very much more concentrated banking systems in other countries,
Canada.
Including Canada, and you don't see these problems. If there's a problem of the excessive power of financial institutions in Washington, D.C., it's not peculiar to the financial sector. I mean, American politics has become venal in a way that recalls the worst excesses of the 19th century, except that the pot of public money is so vastly larger today that the stakes are much, much higher. This is a problem of politics. It should not be confused with a problem of financial regulation. There is no reason at all why the United States should not have some very big, successful banks, whether it's J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs. We will not be safer if Goldman Sachs is split up into three banks, Gold, Man, and Sachs. That won't solve anything, because especially since they'll all basically do the same thing.
They'll be correlated.
The systemic risk will be exactly the same. I think there's a problem of politics in the U.S. I've been more and more concerned by this since I came to live here. And it's a problem which is really hard to solve, because in a way, and we see this very clearly at the moment, it's possible for the politicians to say, we are the solution. Now, we are the solution to this problem. Let us design a bill big enough, long enough, with as many earmarks as possible, and somehow the country will run better. And if we believe that, then we really are, you know, we are mistaking the cure for the disease. Much of what drove this crisis came from Congress. It was Congress that was asleep at the wheel as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac essentially blew themselves up. I mean, it was Congress that was full of people in both parties saying, let's have more home ownership. That was a political rather than an economic story. And I don't hear any talk of significantly improved regulation of politics. But that's actually what we need.
So what would that entail? What does regulation of politics mean in your mind?
Well, the biggest problem clearly arises from the way that in which politics is financed. Now, I don't believe in the naive view that you can solve this problem by Europeanizing finance, but it is clearly the key issue. If the entire system of getting yourself elected and re-elected becomes predicated on your raising ever larger sums from corporate interests that clearly expect something in return, don't be surprised if you end up with 19th century style political corruption. I think Simon Johnson put this well in an article recently in the Atlantic Monthly. We have come dangerously close either to some kind of Latin American syndrome in Washington or just to the Washington of the Gilded Age. I mean, it's not as if the United States hasn't had corrupt politicians before. News just in. This was what everybody commented on when they came and visited the U.S. in the 19th century. What Dickens was appalled by when he came here in the 1840s. So this is nothing new, but it is, I think, the stakes are, as I said, are much higher when the federal government is spending a larger and larger proportion of gross domestic product. That's what needs regulating. Of course, there was an attempt, John McCain was involved in it, to try and come up with a better system of campaign finance. I don't think it worked brilliantly, but that is as big an issue to me as any of the financial regulation that's currently being discussed.
Any of the financial regulation?
Yeah.
So would you be in favor of a system of public financing for elections, basically?
No. I think that's proved to be a disappointment in Europe for one very simple reason, that if you create a situation in which the state pays the parties to run the state, you simply end up with a new kind of corruption. Huh. And moreover, what tends to happen in Europe is that you place caps on what can be raised for politics, for campaigns, which then people go around. And so you end up with more and more of the finance in European politics actually illicit. So that could make matters worse. But let me put it this way. This is the problem to which we should be devoting as much attention as we currently devote to the issue of bank regulation. There's a wonderful Latin tag, which is worth reminding people of on an almost daily basis. And it goes like this: Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who guards the guards? Who regulates the regulators? And we constantly forget that this can't be solved by the very institution, Congress, that was as much responsible for the crisis as any of the private sector institutions.
Now, one of the things I think about your take on the crisis is that I think you give the American people you essentially let them off in a way, which is sort of a strange thing for me to say, perhaps. But you were on Glenn Beck in February, and you talked about, you basically painted a picture of the American people as, in a sense, kind of profoundly different from Congress and sort of not necessarily that interested in having big government programs. Isn't Congress, in a sense, responding to voter incentives, especially when it comes to things like home ownership and home prices and, you know, entitlement programs and the rest?
I think any democracy is characterized by the problem that people regard public expenditure as other people's money.
Right.
And they regard the entitlements they receive as things to which they are entitled, unlike the entitlements that other people receive to which they're not.
Right. Keep your government hands off my Medicare.
And I'm not going to say that I let the American people off the hook. That's not fair, James. After all, in Colossus, a book that I published long before this crisis,
right,
in 2004, I warned that the attention deficit disorder in American political life was propelling the United States towards a chronic indebtedness to the rest of the world. I do have to give myself a little pat on the back here. Nobody else does. Colossus ends, the final chapter of Colossus is called The Closing Door, and it makes the point that the way the United States is governed, it is making it increasingly reliant on China. And the fact that there is a chronic structural deficit in the federal government that has absolutely nothing to do with Keynesianism is actually just a product of political economy.
You mean just every year we than we take in because of these entitlements?
I mean, we were bolting a Keynesian policy of fiscal stimulus on top of a massive crisis of public finance that goes back years. That reflects unquestionably a kind of voter myopia. No, we're in favor of the spending, we're against the taxes. And the political parties have come to institutionalize that schizophrenia so that one party stands only for tax cuts and the other party only for public spending. Now, under those circumstances, it's not surprising that the Congressional Budget Office forecasts there will never be a balanced budget in the United States ever again. And they project until 2083 a deficit in the region of $1 trillion every year until 2083. I mean, that is mind-blowing. And you can't say that any voter is behaving responsibly who connives at that. I mean, it is a recipe for national bankruptcy, in my view.
Okay, so that gets us into your more gloomy view of the world, which I think would be useful to sort of spend some time. So your take on where we are headed, the United States, is pretty bleak. Your recent Financial Times column, you said, pigs are us, basically. So pigs are Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. So the financial problems that they are headed for, you think we are headed for. And the scariest part of your forecast is that it's not, as I think many of us kind of console ourselves to the extent that we think about these things, something that's going to happen 15, 20, maybe 40 years down the road when the Social Security and Medicare bill really comes due. But you argue in a recent foreign affairs piece that it could happen very quickly, that actually it's something that... Now, I should say I don't completely agree with you or buy what you're saying, but explain what you mean. Why should we be worried that this is something that could happen in the space of a few years?
It's very tempting to say, when you look at long-term forecasts, well, China's not going to catch up with us until 2027, and Social Security and Medicare won't go bust until maybe the 2030s, and the debt-GDP ratio won't reach 700% until I'm long gone.
700%.
So, well, that's what the Congressional Budget Office says it will be in 2083. Of course, it won't be. That just tells you that we're on an unsustainable path. So it's tempting to say, this is not really...
I'll be dead
really,
by the time
right, this is not my problem. This is my kids' problem when I reflect on how much their education cost. They have it coming. You know, I think that's a really dangerous way of thinking, and I tried in this foreign affairs piece to attack that view that these things happen gradually, because they don't historically. What happens in fiscal crises is that government X carries on Mr. Micawber-like, spending more, taxing less, accumulating debt, and the debt burden rises up towards 90% of GDP, then 100%, and everybody says, well, this is okay. This seems to work.
We're doing fine.
Let's carry on. And the CBO says we can keep doing this till 2083, so let's shake on it. But what happens historically is that there comes a moment, especially if you're reliant on foreign capital, when the investors go, wait a second, did you see in the paper the other day that their interest payments now account for 21% of all the federal tax revenues, which, by the way, is where we will be in 10 years' time, even on the optimistic forecasts that the administration makes in its budget. So more than a fifth of all tax revenues on interest payments? That's a little bit worrying, don't you think? I think that's very worrying. I think that's so worrying we should sell these bonds to hell. Let's sell them. Now, when a bond market mood change happens, when the investor mentality shifts and the expectations change, it's not gradual. It's like, bang, suddenly, as the Greeks discovered only the other day, suddenly you're paying not 3.5% on your loans, on your bonds, you're expected to pay 7%. That's what happened to the Greeks. And that turns your already parlous fiscal position into a disaster. Because you're already paying so much in interest, even at 3.5%, imagine what proportion of your tax revenues are now going at 7%. You know, that's essentially it. You're suddenly doubling. And once you get up above that threshold, once nearly two-fifths of your revenue is going on interest payments, you're a Ponzi scheme. Because all you're doing is raising money to pay people to lend you more money. That has happened in history many times. That is what happened to 18th century France, just to take one of many examples I could cite. And what disturbs me about the United States today, a country I love and am devoted to and want to live in, is that there is such complacency that people think it can't happen here. Ah, we've got the mighty dollar. Ah, we can just print the money. As if that's consoling. I mean, we should be consoled that we can always print our way out of this. That's a really, really disturbing line of argument.
Well, but
and
is,
yet that's what people say.
But there is some consolation in that, right? I mean, Greece can't do anything, essentially. Their debt is not denominated in their own currency. They can't simply run the printing presses. In theory, we can, right, at least in the short term.
I think this is a great misunderstanding. You know, if you look not only at the fact that half the debt is held by foreigners, half, but also that the term structure is so short that this has to be rolled over. Most of this has to be rolled over in a very short time frame.
Because it is mysterious that we're not borrowing at longer-term rates given how cheap they are.
Yeah, we're not doing it because we probably couldn't.
Right.
And the reason that we can't is that nobody wants to lend the United States on a 10-year time frame anymore. The Chinese certainly don't. They've massively reduced their exposure to the long end of the yield curve. And this is really, really interesting. Because it means that when this thing starts to happen, when we say blithely, well, we'll just inflate our way out of it, the bond market says, oh, no, you won't. You know, we're not going to stand around taking negative real interest rates and being paid off in worthless paper. We will compensate. We want compensation for this. You sell the bonds. And if you have to roll the debt over in a relatively short time frame, there is no place to hide. And this, I think, is a really major misunderstanding that characterizes much of the debate these days. And intelligent men, Martin Wolf in the Financial Times, right, don't seem to see this. If expectations change about the future path of U.S. inflation or the exchange rate of the dollar, overnight the markets can require compensation in the form of higher yields, literally overnight.
But obviously one of the reasons why people feel complacent, whatever you want to call it, is because the collective judgment of the bond market feels very differently than you do, right? I mean, because otherwise they would be asking for that now. I mean, if this is going to happen.
Hang on a minute, James. Are you going to start giving me that collective wisdom of markets
yeah.
stuff again? Like, oh, the markets have priced it in. I mean,
yeah.
if I wish I had a dollar for everybody. Every time I've been told the markets have priced something in, that they've completely failed to price.
No. Of course it fails. But, I mean, the question is, why should we trust you rather than the bond market?
If you trusted me in 2006
rather than
the bond market, you'd be in a much better place.
Of course, we'd be doing quite well. Of course.
I mean, the reason's really, really clear, isn't it? that the markets are capable of being wrong until they suddenly wake up and become right.
Sure.
This is a really important point. The phrase, the markets have priced it in, should be banned. That should be part of the financial regulation. This phrase should be banned because just look at the evidence. The markets consistently fail to accurately forecast inflation. Over a year, over a decade, look what they think is going to happen at the beginning of any year. Look what actually happens. It's almost never right. So the idea that the markets are prescient and I'm just some raving academic is absurd. I've got one advantage over the markets.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Well, I would say that, but I have an advantage over the markets. Most people in financial markets know no history. They only have their own personal experience to go on. There are a few learned types who know some financial history, but relatively few go back beyond the 1970s. And that is the big difference. If you've got 200, 300, 400 years of data, you are at a big advantage over the people who think, well, it never happened in my lifetime, so it never will happen. Those are the people who walked straight into this crisis with their eyes wide open, saying, like the guy who bet me in early 2007, there would never be another recession in the United States.
What?
He was
willing
to make
that bet. Would never be another recession?
There would never be. He said, we have so fixed this problem. The Great Moderation has been such a success. There will never be another recession in the United States. And I said, you know, I don't like never as a time frame for a bet. Can we be a bit more precise? But that kind of mentality is the unhistorical mentality. This time is different. We're in a new place. This is the new you thing. That mentality is the enemy. Of course, right now, the bond market says it's fine to double the federal debt. It's fine. We'll still take 3.5%.
Right.
But the day that the same people in the same market wake up and go, it's not fine, that will be the day when I'm vindicated and the fiscal crisis comes here.
Okay.
Pigs are us.
I wanted to ask you one more question, but I think we're running out of time. So we're going to ask you, is that okay? Questions from the audience, if that's all right.
And I'll do short answers now. Otherwise, we'll all die of starvation.
All right, let me ask. Come up with them right here.
There's a question here. If you wait for the microphone, then we can
forget the microphone.
Forget the microphone. Okay.
I'm just curious to know what you're invested in.
Oh, good question. A great question.
You know you're in New York when people want free investment advice, you know? Well, I'll give a brief answer. One of the big challenges we face, we didn't quite get to it in our discussion, is to come to terms with the fact that the world is fundamentally shifting from the West, from Western dominance to the rest, not just to the East, but to the rest. And this is hard for us to come to terms with because after 500 years, it's a major trend break in the historical process. For 500 years, Western societies that emanated from Western Europe ran the world. And this is ending. And so the hard thing is to say we are living through a once every half millennium shift, and my portfolio needs to shift too. If you did that 10 years ago, you would be in a much better place than if you stuck with US equities. And I think looking ahead, it's the same story. Home bias is your enemy. Home bias is what makes investors invest in their own country. And I took a decision late last year to completely get out of UK assets because I think the outlook for the UK as one of my honorary pigs is a lot bleaker. I should make it clear that there's a sequence to these things. It's a chain reaction. You know, it begins with Greece. It moves to Spain or Portugal. It then moves maybe to Britain. Japan is probably next in line. But it does eventually get here. My time frame for this, just so that James can't phone me up next week and say, you were wrong, it's not a week, right? This is a year-long, maybe two-year process.
But only 2 years, though.
Oh, yeah, in which we cascade through fiscal crisis in one Western country after another. And that is the outlook. And you have to kind of rebalance with that in mind.
2 years. Okay.
How do you see the political implications of the likely rolling pigs scenario?
Mm. Well, after most financial crises, populism tends to benefit, and you will get a swing to the extremes. Because when people lose their homes, their jobs, their savings, surprisingly, they're mad. And in their anger, they look for politicians who can channel that anger, who can articulate it. And so the field is wide open for the demagogues and the mavericks to play the extremes. It's not guaranteed which way it goes. It can go to the left or it can go to the right. But I'm absolutely sure that we will get a much more volatile political scene, not only in Europe, we're already seeing the first riots in the streets in Athens, but here too. I think one should not underestimate the extent of popular anger at this point and the desire for a fresh kind of politics. The old crowd in Congress are really going to struggle to maintain their position in the face of this populist backlash. And it's a dangerous time. One of the things that makes me think we're in a kind of two-year time frame is that when you start factoring in political uncertainty, that can really spook the markets.
Sure.
Look at the UK. Uncertainty about the election that's happening in just a matter of weeks caused a massive run on the pound only the other day. So when we start looking at November and finding that actually surprising stuff is going to happen, incumbents are going to be falling left, right, and center, when we suddenly see, who knows, some unexpectedly radical figure seizing the initiative of the Republican Party, I think the markets will be similarly anxious. Now, if she were to become a credible contender, and I don't rule that out, I don't think that's completely a zero probability scenario, you can imagine how foreign investors would react. That's the kind of scenario we
I think her comment today about how she used to go to Canada for health care weakened her stance among the
I think
tea
her stance
people.
Is pretty feeble right now.
Yeah.
But you never know.
It's true.
Populism is works this way. Populism turns people who were clowns yesterday into powerful people tomorrow. And that's one of its most unnerving characteristics.
Great. That's right. Back there?
Just one silly question. Explain the myth of gold. What does it mean? It's used in jewelry and a few other things. The rest of it is just in stockpiles. Why?
Yeah. I went into a museum in Athens, funnily enough, last year with George Osborne, Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, we hope future Chancellor of the Exchequer. And the first thing that we saw in the Archaeological Museum in Athens, and I recommend you go there, is the death mask of Agamemnon. It is a stunning work. Pure gold, beaten flat. And I was transfixed by it. And I thought, that's gold. That's the magic of gold. And I went to Peru just in January. And I went to one of the wonderful museums that they have in Lima of Inca ornaments. And there's an almost identical mask there. It has the same dazzling quality. Flat, beaten gold. Shining, impossible to tarnish. Gold has a magical quality to it. My favorite line from all the James Bond films is Goldfinger's famous line, when Sean Connery says, as the laser beam is pointing at his groin, "You don't expect me to talk, do you, Goldfinger?" And Goldfinger replies, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." Gold is magic. That's the whole point of that book. And it is a kind of magic. You know, in a world of paper money, in a world of fiat currencies, it's not surprising that more and more investors have been inclined to allocate a part of their portfolios to this magical, rare, shiny stuff. I mean, it doesn't pay a return in the conventional way, but I just wish I had bought all the gold that Gordon Brown was selling 10 years ago when it was available from the Bank of England at the knockdown price of $300 an ounce.
But there is something bizarre about the notion of gold as a store of value, given that because gold bugs believe somehow that there is something intrinsic to gold, when, of course, it is no different from paper money in the sense of gold works because people are willing to give you things for money.
The difference
for gold,
is that
right?
you can't produce gold the way you
right.
can produce paper money. The supply of paper money is infinitely elastic,
sure.
Constrained only by the number of trees in the world.
But the value of it ultimately depends on exchange, right? I'm willing to give you this real stuff for paper or for gold, right?
It's just another form of money.
Right.
And one of the points I try and make in the Ascent of Money is that anything can be money.
Yeah,
giant stone wheels are money in some Pacific islands. We rely, most of us in this room, on invisible money, money that has no tangible form at all. Gold is a form of money, but it's also a form of jewelry. And it's probably more important in many ways as jewelry at Indian weddings than it is as money. The gold bugs are right in one way and wrong in another. they're right that it makes sense to have this as an asset in a diversified portfolio because gold behaves in odd ways that are not well correlated to other units.
Right.
But they're wrong in thinking we could ever go back to a gold standard. That's the big illusion of the gold cult. And the reason people believe this is that they don't remember what the gold standard did, which was to inflict deflation on the world not once but twice. Did it in the 1870s and 1880s, did it again in the 1930s. Why anybody would want to rerun that, I really don't know.
One more question, and then we need to... I shouldn't say we need to. We get to go to dinner.
On behalf of the audience, I'd like to thank you for a very interesting and fascinating talk. So if we could give our speaker a round of applause.
Thank you.
But I would like to ask you one question about your...
I knew you were setting me up there.
But...
I'd like to ask you a question about your preference for, shall we say, a technocratic solution when it comes to financial regulation as opposed to a political one. Because I wonder how that assesses the great political solution of the U.S. banking history, which is, of course, the 1930s. You have the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover blames the Fed. All of a sudden, you have a political solution in Franklin Roosevelt, who, I should add, never took an economics course. You have a gentleman farmer come in as your Treasury Secretary who never had a day of banking experience, and all of a sudden you have the Gold Reserve Act, the Glass-Steagall Act, you have the 1935 Banking Act, and you have the FDIC regulation, all of which driven by political solutions, by a Democratic Party that didn't read the bills, and this banking regulation solution lasted the United States for 80 years. And I ask you, as a historian, I wonder how you can ignore the great example of U.S. financial regulation history when you say you need to look back 300 years and see this in structure. I might just ask you to go back 80 years and tell us, was that not in fact a political solution to a financial regulatory question?
Well, it was certainly a political solution, but you must remember that its economic benefits were very limited. The New Deal was a wonderful way of generating new employment in the federal government, and it was unquestionably a period of great innovativeness in the legislature. But its macroeconomic consequences were negligible, and the U.S. was back in recession, if not depression, in 1937. What propelled the U.S. recovery was World War II. And let me be more precise. It was the impact of the huge fiscal stimulus of the war on an economy that had continued to be highly innovative, both managerially and technologically, even through the teeth of the Depression. Now, this is an important note on which to end. We very easily forget the role of technological innovation and entrepreneurship in driving economic growth in all economies, but in the United States economy, most of all. If anything is going to get us out from underneath this pile of debt, it will be the continuation of innovation and the success of entrepreneurship. It won't be regulation, any more than it was regulation that got the U.S. out of the Depression. My sense is that the U.S., more than Europe, still has a way out of here. There is a way out of a mountain of debt that doesn't mean default and doesn't mean inflation. But it has to involve two things. One, you have to make sure that people are still incentivized to innovate and to be entrepreneurs. This still has to be the best country in the world to have a good idea and turn it into a good business. And the second and closely related thing is that there has to be fiscal reform so that those people who are contemplating innovation and entrepreneurship are not deterred by the prospect of massive tax rises or inflation at some point 5 or 10 years down the line when their initial investment might just be paying off. I think the most urgent thing that we can do to avert the descent of the West, to avert that major shift in power from the United States to China and other non-Western countries, is fiscal reform. And until I hear a politician come up with a credible plan to put the United States back on course to fiscal stability through tax reform, through entitlement reform, to shifting the retirement age, unless I'm hearing that from a politician, that person will be a charlatan in my eyes. But it can be done. The United States can do this. It's not difficult to devise reform of income tax, reduction of corporation tax, the introduction either of a sales tax or a value-added tax to bring the budget back into equilibrium. You can see what needs to be done. It's just that the political will seems completely absent. And that brings me back to my original point. It's political regulation. It's political reform this country needs, much more than financial regulation.
But it's political will on the part of voters as well, right?
Oh, yeah. They need to know what they need to know what to look for. There should be a checklist of, is your candidate a charlatan? And I'll provide three simple questions on the back of a card. You can check.
All right. Well, on that quasi-hopeful note, I guess, you said there is some way we might get out. That's as hopeful as you're going to get. We will call an end to it, and we'll go up to dinner. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. It's
nice
great.
Job.
Well, there's not really very much to add to that. I don't even think we have time for dinner. I think we have to go out and innovate and do all these things before the decline of the West. I just have a few more thank yous. All of you are real big-time supporters, and you're so generous. That's one thing America really does in a great way, is they really support their institutions that are very important. And Louise Grunewald and Alice Tisch, myself, want to thank you and know that you're very, very appreciated. The other thing I'd like to say is to the staff, you know these evenings are a lot of work, and you know who you are. Thank you. Rhonda Sherman, who comes up, who's Neil was her idea. David Mon for a beautiful decor upstairs. And Louise wanted to say, I think we're having a festive dinner. It's a repeat by popular demand. I hope I said that correctly, Louise, wherever you are. And also to our new members, God bless you, Caroline and Thompson Dean, Susie Kinsey, the Piggott family, Cherry Henderson and David Poppy, Susan and Elihu Rose, Laura and Richard Solomon, and Mark Siegel. Thank you for joining the President's Council. Now we're going to go upstairs for dinner, third floor, the elevator. There'll be direction to that. And I can only say thank you again, and we'll see you in the fall. And thank you, fellas. You are absolutely amazing.